Before we get started, this is a longer episode than normal, so I am going to include an intermission. All right, let's do this.
You're listening to Band Sounds with Phil Corbett.
What do you know about yodeling? Yeah, until this winter, me neither. So, assuming you know nothing about the yodel, I want to start off with a few songs that recently caught my ear.
Way out in Arizona, in a town they call Winona, where the folks you meet all know a thing or two. Lived a lad of great ambition, who had set as his life's mission to excel upon his only today. And he played a little tune on his Spanish guitar. He'd mingle with the song, the sweet refrain.
Take me back to my boots and saddle. Ooh.
That is really the main thing in the yodel. That's what defines a yodel. It's just an action in the larynx that changes the vibrations that the vocal folds create.
This is Tim Wise.
I'm Tim Wise. The name of my book is Yodeling and Meaning in American Music.
In other words, he's the guy that wrote the book on yodeling. So the most basic definition of yodeling is the act of breaking your voice between vocal registers. That's like chest voice, where I'm talking now, and head voice, or falsetto. And the reason I'm making that distinction is that the physical act of yodeling is pretty simple and it exists all over the world. But it's the stylization and the patterns that make it unique and recognizable as yodeling.
It's common in a lot of singing styles, and there's evidence of yodeling in all kinds of music all over the planet. But in the United States, people tend to associate yodeling with the Swiss and the people in that area, the Alps.
So those first three songs we heard, those were all American yodeling, specifically cowboy yodeling. And if you've watched basically any of the early singing cowboy movies, you'll know that yodeling is very common. It's as if every cowboy on the range spent most of his day on the edge of a canyon yodeling to the coyotes.
I love to sing this yodeling cowboy song.
So I found myself wondering, how the hell did yodeling get into cowboy music? And why the hell does it fit so perfectly? European yodeling made it to America well before recording technology existed, so all of the evidence is in sheet music.
And on this sheet music, it mentions the names of some pretty famous opera singers from Europe. They seem to be the clearest indication of European singers introducing yodeling into America, into professional circles.
Tim points out that there's really no way of knowing if there were Swiss immigrants and folk singers yodeling in America before that. Professionally speaking, we can say that the Swiss yodeling likely made it to America in the 1820s.
And about a decade or so after that, you started to get the first wave of family singing groups from the Tyrol and from Switzerland performing in America.
These Swiss singing groups would travel the country, and if you lived outside of the major urban centers, which most Americans did at the time, traveling musicians would likely be a major form of entertainment, a sort of tether to the outside world. But these traveling Swiss performers were not the only people breaking their voice on purpose in America at the time.
We know from ethnomusicologists that in Africa, for example, there's a considerable amount of yodel technique. It doesn't sound at all like the Alpine stuff because it's different rhythms and different pitches and different types of melodies, and so it doesn't resemble it, but it has that same laryngeal switching that I'm talking about.
It appears that intentional voice breaks were a common trait of slave songs, and they defined the vocal technique of a lot of Black American music up through the development of the blues, where it's worth mentioning those breaks are still common. So voice breaking was going on both in touring Alpine bands and in Black music, separate from each other, at the same time. And it's in this climate, in the mid-1800s, that one of the United States' first entertainment crazes shows up. Minstrel shows. Traveling musical acts that are most known for blackface. White people performing very, very racist caricatures of Black people. Minstrels would sometimes travel as well with female impersonators, very early versions of drag shows, and would sometimes imitate fellow traveling entertainers, including the singing Swiss.
Many of these minstrel shows actually imitated these Alpine singers who were traveling throughout the United States, and so yodeling got into that. But since they were imitating African singing songs, it makes sense that they might have been doing yodel effects in songs like that. We just don't know. But when the recording industry began in the 1880s, but it didn't take off until the 1890s, we have recordings of white people imitating Blacks, the old hangover of the minstrel show. And they are very frequently breaking their voice with yodels, and that doesn't sound remotely like the Alpine singing, but it indicates that these white performers who were trying to imitate the African Americans were doing things that they associated with their performance styles.
Minstrel shows derided Black Americans specifically by portraying them as uneducated and unsophisticated. The use of voice breaking was a shorthand for that. Bouncing between registers was something civilized people would never do. As minstrel shows disappeared in the late 1800s, they were replaced by a new type of musical variety act called vaudeville. Vaudeville featured a larger, less racist cast of characters. Most of those character archetypes were more nuanced, and they would make fun of each other instead of just teaming up on one group. A few performance styles from minstrel shows did pass through to vaudeville, though, like drag and the yodel.
One of its functions in the latter part of the 19th century was to mark out the ethnicity of German comic characters, the so-called Dutch character in vaudeville and music theater. And these are kind of country bumpkins from Germany, as they were presented this way on the stage, that they were country bumpkins, you know, good, honest, wholesome people, but kind of unsophisticated and couldn't master the language. And when they sang, they yodeled.
The yodel was uncivilized. The yodel was wild and unrestrained.
If anybody just starts on some low note and sings upward, just a kind of, just going up like that, they will reach a point where their voice breaks. That's the vocal break, and that's the point at which this yodel effect occurs.
Wait, let's try that real quick. Sing along with me. Yeah, there it is.
It's an inevitable physiological process in any body. But because the received normative style of singing in Europe, which was transplanted into America, conceals that break, and a trained singer does everything they can to make the upper register of their voice have the same tone color as the lower and middle register of their voice, that's considered good singing. And so the yodel technique violates that principle. It celebrates this break, and it really kind of, when you're yodeling back and forth, you're really just kind of pointing to that break, so to speak. And that is considered not good singing style in a sense. It's not the way your voice would be trained in a music school or a conservatory.
The yodel, even though difficult to master, was still considered untrained and unsophisticated, sung by people in the sticks.
Yodeling in the European music seems always associated with a pre-industrial idea, a pastoral society. It was a kind of a romantic thing when these alpine shepherds would break into song and yodel. It indicated how far they were from the sophisticated cities. So I do think that yodeling has, throughout its career in the United States, been associated with romantic characters and also with characters who are, let's say, unsophisticated and rural, and at odds. That's my dog yodeling, and at odds with the mainstream urban society.
I think we're onto something.
One is roundup time in Texas, and bloom is on the sage. Let alone to be in Texas, back riding on the range. Just smell the bacon frying when sizzling in the pan. Hear the breakfast horn in the early morn, drinking coffee from a can.
Americans have a complicated relationship with what we consider wild. We have a deep cultural admiration for that which is untethered by civilization, and a deep cultural urge to tether it. And as we reach the late 1920s and early 30s, a single figure emerges to capture this exact part of our shared imagination. And that figure, of course, is the cowboy. I can't afford the rights to that. The cowboy, a romantic lone figure in the wild American West, the perfect embodiment of American resilience, self-sufficiency, resourcefulness, and grit. And boy, could that guy yodel. There was a cowboy character in vaudeville, usually a man in a big hat singing trail songs, and this character archetype was inspired by actual cowboys, but was by no means much like them. This is largely because cowboys were a very diverse and sprawling bunch of people. Evidence is hard to come by, but census data suggests that upwards of 15 to 20% of cowboys were black, Around a third were Mexican vaqueros, and the remaining half-ish were a mix of European Americans and European immigrants. So, if they sang, they probably sang a lot of different styles. And we don't know if yodeling was among them.
My heart's plumb full of song. Odelay, odelay, odelay. I sing as I go along. Odelay, deal, odelay. Ain't nothing worries me. Odelay, deal, odelay. Don't you wish that you were me?
If the original cowboys weren't yodeling to the coyotes, where did that notion come from? Did the Alpine yodeling characters in vaudeville teach the cowboy characters how to yodel? I mean, it's certainly possible. I figured one way to find out would be to track down one of these vaudeville cowboy characters and just ask him.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm Sourdough Slim here, last of the vaudeville cowboys. As a child, I had this ability to go into a falsetto, drive everybody nuts. And so as I got older and got into cowboy music, and of course, it fit right in. Are you kidding me? Yeah, I was set. And so I've been yodeling away almost my whole life and yodeling to cowboy tunes, all kinds of stuff.
I first saw Sourdough Slim in 2017 at the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering, and his act combines accordion songs, yodeling, physical humor, and just all-around showmanship. So I headed down to a brewery in Winters, California to catch him again. And during a break between sets, he agreed to an interview by his tour van on the edge of the parking lot.
And that's something that I've been researching a lot, is why yodeling fits so well with.
Awesome. Thank you. See you again.
You know, just why yodeling fits so well with cowboy music.
Yes.
And that's such an interesting, you know, jump.
It's you know, the introduction to it was through the blues singers, the black blues singers that had kind of a yodel that they did. And Jimmy Rogers, who was very popular back in the late 20s, and he became known as the father of country music, of course. But Jimmy was the guy that introduced yodeling into country music.
That gal that made a wreck out of me.
And everybody wanted to do what Jimmy did. He was the best. So he introduced it, and after that, after the late 20s, cowboy music was synonymous with yodeling. So,
and do you think is there a sonic reason for that? I've been thinking a lot about, I mean, yodeling from, you know, Switzerland is all about, you know, communicating over these vast distances.
I know
it.
That's what they do. They communicate by yodeling across the canyons. You know, one herdsman yodeling to the other, and I don't know what they're saying.
You don't speak yodel after all?
Well, I speak it, but I don't understand it.
I'm going back where I come from. I leave my worries far behind. I'm back in back, I'm leaving in the morning. Oh, I've got the minds of me so mine. Yodeling, yodeling.
So Swiss yodeling came from rural herders communicating across vast landscapes, and cowboys were rural herders living in vast landscapes. Maybe that's all it took for the idea to catch on.
Kipchar. $10 bill, five. $1 bill.
The parallel histories of yodeling from people in the Alps, people in Africa, and in Hawaii, Samoa, and Mexico all found themselves converging in America in the early 20th century. And one guy who seemed influenced by each of these styles and by vaudeville simply put them together. Jimmy Rogers, the father of country music, recorded a series of songs called the Blue Yodels, mixing blues, folk, and yodeling. At this point, I should mention it had nothing to do with cowboys.
He began at very late, I say late, he died a very young man from tuberculosis, but some of his later recordings are romantic cowboy songs. And presumably he got this idea because he moved from Mississippi to Kerrville, Texas, because he had tuberculosis and he was advised to go to a drier climate and he would breathe better.
That was a common treatment at the time.
And so once he was in Texas, he started, wearing cowboy-style outfits for publicity shots and singing romantic cowboy songs. I say romantic cowboy songs because they weren't really songs that actual cowboys sang. They were specially composed popular songs that glamorized or romanticized the life of the cowboy. And he added yodeling to these. And this seems to have really started a trend because later singers like Gene Autry picked up on this style and he became the most famous of the so-called singing cowboys in the films, B-movies, with the singing cowboy who's invariably yodeled. And yes, from there it spread out. It was really mediated on a massive level then because it was not only the radio but film, and this is the image of the singing cowboy who yodels. It's strictly a convention. It's a made-up thing, a Hollywood idea, but it caught on and it's very popular and people still love it.
A practice that began in the lungs of African hunters and alpine herders passed through the lungs of slaves and minstrels and traveling showmen until eventually it filled the lungs of a man in America who loved the blues. And those lungs got tuberculosis. He moved to Texas and began singing romantic cowboy songs, and when people heard that, they thought, yeah, this fits. And that is how the mythic Western cowboy learned to yodel.
I don't know. I love to yodel. It's great for the digestion. People don't know that. It's great for the lungs, of course. That makes sense. Spans the lungs. And actually, my favorite benefit of yodeling is it always allows me a little privacy around the house. Oh, yeah. I can clear out a whole neighborhood.
You know, it's not working right now. People are sticking
around. No, people are sticking. It's the beer, believe me. Not the yodeling, it's the beer. Yeah.
Way out in Arizona in a town they call Winona, where the folks you meet all know a thing or two. Live the land of great ambition.
Well, we've made it to the intermission. I'm just going to play this entire song from 1929, the Dzurek Sisters with Arizona Yodeler. We will get rolling again in about 2 minutes.
In the evening in the cactus, you would get a lot of practice on his yodel. As his cattle he was trailing, you would always hear him wailing on his yodel. Once a big shot from the city heard him warbling the ditty, and a company was oddly. Then he said, "Look here, my sonny, you can make a lot of money with the oddly." And he'd play a little tune on his Spanish guitar. He'd mingle with a song this sweet refrain. Then our hero took the tip and packed his rip and took a trip and soon was singing o'er the radio to you. If the Swiss heard what he's earning, green with envy they'd be turning when he soon he met a little maiden who with talents who was laden, and she fell for him like flowers for the dew. And he wished not to evade her, and he used to serenade her with his and he played a little tune on his Spanish guitar. He'd mingle with a song the sweet refrain.
You'll be the expert on the music that's out there, but the coyote stuff, yeah, we can for sure talk about. My name is Dan Flores. I'm a writer who lives now in New Mexico, just outside Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Dan Flores wrote a book a couple years ago called Coyote America.
The full title of it is Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. And I gave it that subtitle because the book is the biography of an animal that has played a pretty remarkable role in American history. I mean, it's a indigenous native animal, the whole canid family of animals, in fact, all the dogs and jackals and hyenas and wolves of the world all evolved in North America 5 million years ago and then spread around the world. The coyote is one of them that never left North America. It remained here.
For thousands of years, the coyote carved out an evolutionary niche in the American West and was revered by humans that lived there.
There is a body of stories out there. In fact, it's the oldest literature in North America that are coyote stories. And there are, of course, Indian accounts of this coyote deity figure who, among Western Indians, became kind of a crucial deity or semi-deity. And was also in the stories that Indians told about him, he was kind of an avatar for humans. He was a stand-in. And that's kind of the way coyotes have functioned a lot in their history. They did so for Indian people for 10,000 years of these coyote stories, where coyote, the figure in the stories, he stands on his hind legs. He has hands with opposable thumbs. I mean, he's got erect coyote ears, and he's got a long snout, and he's got a tail, but he's really sort of a coyote man. And the role he plays in the stories is to teach people about who human beings are. In other words, what he really is doing is he's teaching us about human nature.
You sort of lay out in the book this timeline of, you know, people being really impressed by coyotes, and still there, it was like a very interesting, nuanced take on coyote in these stories. And they kind of went from that point to outright contempt for a long time in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah, well, it's a roller coaster story, as you indicate. For Indian people who don't domesticate and herd animals, they don't really have any fear or any concerns about predators. I mean, Indians are never worried about wolves. They never worry about mountain lions. And they certainly don't ever worry about coyotes. In fact, instead of worrying about them, they tend to observe them very closely and try to learn about themselves and about the world by observing these animals. But when Europeans come over here 500 years ago, they bring out of the old world all these domesticated animals, sheep and goats and cattle, and they've been fighting predators ever since domestication happened, which was 6,000 or 7,000 years ago.
So as Europeans colonized North America and began moving west, they brought with them a general policy. Predators must be killed on sight.
They translate this hatred for predators onto not just wolves and mountain lions and bears, but coyotes as well. And so what's kind of interesting about the story is that although Europeans come to North America 500 years ago without any preconceived notions about coyotes, because there are no coyotes in Europe.
In fact, American explorers spend a lot of the 1800s arguing over what these things even were.
Is it some kind of small wolf? Lewis and Clark called coyotes prairie wolves. They thought they were a version of wolves, and I mean, in a way, biologically, they were correct about that. But nobody really knew much about them. They just kind of, and this is almost a classic American thing we do, I believe, is we go ahead and sort of adopt a stance about something, in this case, an animal, without ever closely investigating it.
Many Americans' introduction to coyotes was a passage in Roughing It, a book by Mark Twain.
And he's got about a 4-page comic description of coyotes in that book. And people sort of used Mark Twain's descriptions over the next 30 or 40 years to decide that coyotes were just breathing up good air. I mean, and we may as well just go ahead and wipe them out. So we even reach a point by 1931, where the federal government, the United States Congress, passes a law, the Animal Damage Control Act, which is designed to exterminate coyotes from North America. And we pass that law and appropriate $10 million to exterminate them, mostly using poisons, before we have ever done any science to actually try to figure out, so what role do they play in nature? What do they actually eat? Are they really a threat? I mean, we don't bother to do the science until a decade after we've already decided we're going to wipe them out. I mean, we launch in America this campaign of extermination against coyotes. We have a lab, a federal lab, called the Eradication Methods Lab, that's designed to create one new poison after another in order to try to wipe these animals out. So we go for like 75 years, you know, and do everything we can with millions of poison baits out across the American West and try to completely destroy coyotes all over the United States.
I'd like to read an excerpt from that Mark Twain passage. The coyote is a long, slim, sick, and sorry-looking skeleton with a gray wolf skin stretched over it. A tolerably bushy tail that forever sags down with a despairing expression of forsakenness and misery. A furtive and evil eye and a long, sharp face with slightly lifted lip and exposed teeth. He has a general slinking expression all over. The coyote is a living, breathing allegory of want. He is always hungry. He is always poor, out of luck, and friendless.
I mean, what I more or less profile is a period of about 30 or 40 years after Mark Twain writes this passage, where writers sort of attempted to outdo one another in castigating coyotes. I mean, one of the stories I tell is about a writer doing a story for Scientific American, actually, in 1920. I mean, this is right after World War I, right after the Russian Revolution. And this guy basically writes a story for Scientific American where he encourages Americans to shoot coyotes on sight, and then goes on to say, I realize that they're not worth the cost of the ammunition that it takes to kill them, but you should go ahead and kill them for patriotic reasons, because after all, the coyote is the original Bolshevik. In other words, coyotes are communists.
Americans have a complicated relationship with what we consider wild. We have a deep cultural admiration for that which is untethered by civilization, and a deep cultural urge to tether it. For millions of years, a single figure roamed the land, a perfect embodiment of American resilience, self-sufficiency, resourcefulness, and grit. And that figure, of course, is the coyote. I can't afford the rights to that. The coyote isn't seen as much as he is heard. As Dan writes in the chapter, A War on Wild Things, most human interaction with coyotes is hearing them at night. And as Europeans moved west, the way they wrote about waking at night to the sound of coyotes was less than romantic.
I mean, and they used terms like hideous and blood-curdling and, you know, makes you wake up in bed at night in a cold sweat. And I mean, all these, in fact, one of the most commonly used adjectives for a coyote howl by people from European backgrounds was, it was alien. In North America, the coyote's howl was the last thing from being alien. The Europeans were the aliens, in fact, and the coyote was, in fact, the native animal that had been howling that howl for 5 million years in North America. I mean, and I've got writer friends who have described coyote howls as maniacal, like a bunch of maniacs. Coyotes have a remarkable ability as ventriloquists. And so what people will often hear and decide, wow, that's a pack of 10 or 12 coyotes just going crazy. And what they will often say, it's part of the urban legend thing, they must have made a really big kill, because the more of them that are howling and the louder it is, the bigger the kill they made. Well, what they're actually usually hearing are about two coyotes, possibly three. Humans tend to hear it that way, and in part we hear it that way because they howl in a lot of different registers. I mean, people hear that. I mean, I'd still have folks say that to me over coffee or over beers. Man, I heard 15 coyotes last night. They must have brought down a mule deer or something. And I have to say, well, probably what you heard was three. And no, those howls are not in exultation at having made a kill. This is how they communicate with one another. And I mean, they're sort of endlessly, the packs are endlessly howling in order to establish and confirm their territories. And they're also kind of doing a census of how many coyotes are in a local landscape. And so it's one of the ways that they adjust their numbers, actually.
Yeah, you heard that right. Coyotes not only communicate across landscapes with their voices, but they howl to take a census. and depending on the response they get, they will adjust how big their litters are.
Yeah, the absence of answering coyote howls in an area seems to trigger some sort of chemical response in the females. And I mean, the way this actually works is that if the coyote population has been suppressed because people are trying to poison them out or shoot them from helicopters or something, what that often will mean is that it's possible for the female coyotes to raise more of their pups to adulthood. It sort of functions in several different ways. They do tend to have bigger litters, but they can also raise their pups more effectively.
Now, that ability wasn't evolved because of humans. Instead, coyotes evolved to resist this harassment from a different predator, the wolf. But when humans, out of nowhere, seemingly, started eradicating both of these animals, these old adaptations just kicked in.
Coyotes just called on those old evolutionary adaptations. The primary one is what's called a fission-fusion response.
One more time, the fission-fusion response.
What that means is that coyotes are one of the rare mammals. We humans happen to be one of the other mammals that also evolved this ability, that can function both in groups and as singles or pairs. So coyotes normally are in fusion mode. They will have litters of pups that will become the pack of an alpha pair.
And if they are unable to survive in a group because of harassment, they will break into singles and pairs and then scatter.
And so they go into fission mode at that point, meaning they break apart and scatter. And when they do that, it stimulates them to colonize. And so one of the bizarre consequences of our 75-year war of trying to exterminate coyotes in the American West is that we spread them all across the United States.
In fact, we have spread them so far that coyotes are now in every single state except for Hawaii.
Everybody who goes to sleep in the city of Chicago, more than 8 million people, every time they lay their head on the pillow and turn out the lights and go to sleep at night, there's a coyote within a half mile of them. And I mean, that's sort of a new way to think about American urban living.
We have a complicated relationship with that which is wild. And if sophistication means exterminating entire species and refusing to let our voices crack, what does that say about us? In the way that alpine herders yodeled from mountaintops, the mythic singing cowboy yodeled across the canyon. And in that same way, the coyote still yodels from the ridge across the valley.
They're shouting out across the valley, you know, and as I say in Coyote America, I mean, they've been doing this here for 5 million years. And so if we think of America in the proper sense as not a new place, but a very old place that stretches back across millions of years of time, I mean, the coyote howl is the original American national anthem.
Was a cowboy I knew in South Texas. His face was burnt deep by the sun.
Van Sounds is produced by me, Phil Corbett. You can find the show on PRX, leave a review on iTunes, follow on Twitter, or visit vansounds.org. And I will post a link to both Tim Wise and Dan Flores' books below.
Sit out under the stars of the Milky Way and listen while the coyotes howl. They go,
There were a lot of yodel examples in this episode, so I went ahead and made a yodeling playlist on YouTube with all of them. So I will put that in the episode description. The non-example music in this episode was Roots Connective and Beat Tape Coop by Yclept Insan, a song I recorded called The Circuit City in Newark, Delaware, a yodel song I recorded live by Sourdough Slim and Robert Armstrong, The Arizona Yodeler by the Dezurek Sisters, Italics by Poor Tur, an accordion song I wrote for this episode called Coyote Trot Number 1, and finally, this song, Coyotes, by Don Edwards, used with permission. Thanks for listening, and keep moving.
He'd say all that's left now of the old days, damned old coyotes and me, and they go, ooh, yep, ooh, yep, ooh, ooh, yep. Now the longhorns are gone, and the drovers are gone, the Comanches are gone, the outlaws are gone, now Quantro's gone, Stanwante's gone, and the lion is gone, and the red wolf is gone. One morning they searched his adobe. He disappeared without even a word. But that night as the moon crossed the mountain, one more coyote was heard.